Hello and welcome to Minter Dialogue, episode number 401. My name is Minter Dial, and I'm your host for this podcast. This week's interview is with Molly Kellogg. Molly is the president and CEO of Hubbard Hall, a specialty chemicals business that was founded in 1849. As the sixth generation head of the family business, Molly Kellogg is shepherding Hubbard Hall through change, not least of which has been the challenges of this pandemic. In this conversation with Molly, we discuss her leadership style, how she has led the company through a transformational journey, lessons learned, and how and why purpose has been an important part of their success, as well as how ice hockey has played an important part in Molly's life. You'll find all the show notes on MinterDial.com. Please do consider to drop in your rating and review. And don't forget to subscribe to catch all the future episodes. Now for the show. Molly Kellogg. My goodness, how fun is it to have a old-time friend? We went to business school together. We played grass hockey together memorably. And you are currently 4,500 titled head of Hubbard Hall. In your own words, how would you like to describe yourself, Molly?
Well, that's a challenging question from the outset. I think if I think about my role as leader of the company, I think skills that I bring to it, I think I'm creative. I think I'm forward thinking and still bound by an incredible tradition in our company. So we go back 179 years. And
congratulations.
Thank you. And that was a lot of luck, I think, if I look back, and good financial stewardship. But so as I think about what I do, I'm bound by this incredible tradition. It's also a great gift and a legacy. So I'm trying to build the business. And as I think about what I'm trying to do, it's not to build it up and have one of those liquidity moments or hit a number, but trying to build it for generation number 7. And so how I take an old-fashioned business and think about executing to build something sustainable in the, you know, the best sense of the word, not the more popular sense of the word. So this business is here for generation number 7, and then also giving back to the communities that we operate in. So a lesson that I learned at my father's on the other side of the conference room table over 25 years of working with him.
That's beautiful. And of course, you are a mother of 4. You are also a rabid and very good ice hockey player, multi-talented. One of the things that I wanted to ask you, Molly, as we get into this, is so you're the CEO and chairperson, I should say, of Hubbard Hall. We both went to business school in Fontainebleau a few years back. What has that, if it did, bring to you in your job as the head of Hubbard Hall?
I'd say in some ways, Minter brought me everything. And from a character development point of view, it was the hardest I've ever had to work, coming from as a comparative literature major, not having like done a lick of math since probably freshman year in high school. You know, I actually failed the math section of the GMAT.
The GMAT, right?
So I was incredibly intimidated coming into that and had to work so hard just to keep up a little bit. So that, you know, as a competitive person, that gave me a little bit of extra, I think, resiliency and grit. And then from a pure MBA point of view, it gave me the toolbox, right? I may not remember how to do a Black-Scholes option pricing model, but I know it's out there.
You know it exists.
I know
it's more than I remember.
Yeah. And then, you know, the other really, really special part about INSEAD was being able to live with and experience life for a year with people from all over the world, and you know, doing that work in the groups that was so important. And I don't know, it's just, if I look back at my life, that's a top 5 year, really. So wow.
That's lovely to hear. And sixth generation, so there are a lot of things that really crop up with that thought. First of all, not so many companies survive 4 generations. Statistics bear that out. As you get, you know, down to the sixth generation like you, you've lost your hunger. It's sort of spoon fed. you've probably got a silver spoon, you know, stuck up somewhere kind of thing feeling, and how do you do it? So on top of that, you're in a business that I can't imagine is hugely female. From my understanding of industry and chemicals and specialty chemicals, I mean, I'm sure there are plenty, but is that a novelty, so to speak? And how has it been for you? Does that have any bearing on your existence as the CEO?
I think currently has no bearing on my existence as CEO, right? So I'd say not currently, but in terms of my professional development, what I've been able to do with the company, it has helped being female for two reasons. I think one is sometimes I'm the only female in the room, so people just remember me, right? So then if I want to go back out and make connections, I don't have to explain, right, who I am. And then, you know, I think growing up in our generation, our age, Minter, I was also underestimated at times. And so I would maybe learn things or people would say things to me that perhaps they thought I didn't understand. And so it was a real competitive advantage.
Because you're blonde, you know.
That's it, right? And I've gotten blonder over the years. I don't know how that's happened, but it's an amazing part of aging.
Well, I want to layer in on that a second, because I studied, like you, comparative literature, but my minor was women's studies. And one of my observations has been, you ask a man to do something who's never done it before, he says, yeah, I can do it. Yeah. You ask a woman who's done it five times before, well, I'm not sure I can do it. Yeah. You go to a business school, oh, I've got to compete more because, you know, who am I to do it in that rank? Do you feel that there was any of that in your existence and how you had to prove yourself and make yourself more... or stronger as a leader?
Yeah, probably. Although I didn't pay a lot of attention to it, Minter, because I think being a competitive athlete is just put your head down and go forward. So I never saw, I never felt like I was competing against men. I was probably more competing against myself. And I saw more of the advantages of being a female than not. And maybe there's some that just sort of went by me I never paid attention to. So I don't know, but you know, it's funny that the women's studies thing, I saw a great example of the male approach to life and female approach to life with my children. So three girls go through driver's ed here in the States, right? You've got to go out, you got to drive with your parent. They come in, they say that, oh my gosh, it was terrible. I had so much to work on, and they were fine. My son, the youngest of four, goes out to drive with me the first time. And I mean, three times I'm grabbing the wheel. He hit a curb, nearly hit a cop, walks in the door and says, that was flawless. I'm like, no, it wasn't. But that female, like that doubt, right? That self, like, oh my gosh, I don't really know how to do it. The male approach, I'm really pretty good, you know? So it's funny.
It is extraordinary. And you know, you still have to wonder if it's inculcated or let's say natural. I think the jury feels out on that, but overall there does seem to be a reality that, which in my mind leads me to say, well, that's good that we're different, because right. It's that complementarity, that difference of perspectives, the sometimes the bravery, sometimes the intelligent and analysis, and let's say more conservative double thinking about something that is a useful, you know, to and fro.
Right. I agree. And the other thing I think about, so yes, we've got celebrate the differences and that's fine and it's good. One danger that, or, you know, a gap that I see myself falling into, so this male assumption of authority and the female maybe more passive role. And so when I'm listening to people speak and in our company, and you think I'd be highly attuned to this as a woman, but, you know, the men tend to speak like radio announcers and very confident. And so I can be, if I'm not careful, swayed by the tone of their voice rather than actually what they're saying. And the women who tend to be a little bit more apologetic and laugh when they're speaking, I may more readily dismiss what they're saying. So this the difference between, I've heard it described as, you know, confidence versus competence, right? Men come across as competent and that becomes a heuristic for competence, and it's not, and vice versa.
So it's fascinating, because I mean, at the end of the day, we are still also we're trained, we come up with experiences, and we also have stresses like time. Yeah. And you know, someone speaking, and then you need to be able to allocate airtime when right. someone doesn't want to speak up. And how do you encourage
right.
speaking up when they feel timid or they don't feel empowered or right. whatever it is, despite the fact that you're at the head of the table?
Right.
It can still happen. And you know, as a white male in a position of leadership, I recall men or women who were timid having to notice that.
Yeah.
And then, hey, listen, let's go around the table and get everybody engaged and participating.
Yeah, and I think, you know, as a female leader, one of the natural talents, if you will, that I brought to it was perhaps being more empathetic and attuned to others. And so it naturally comes to me to listen and to go around the table and you know, seek out what I'm not hearing. And the other thing that I've sort of found interesting in this pandemic time, right? So you read an article from McKinsey saying the trick to leadership is authenticity. And it just cracks me up because I feel like that's how I feel like I've always been as a leader. I think that's a very female trait that you have to tell men to be authentic and that's how you're going to be a leader. It's like, come on, really? I mean, why is that a headline in any business article at all?
Isn't that a beautiful statement, Molly? So you guys are privately held. Give us, yeah. if you can, what you're allowed to give us a little bit of a feeling of your business size and ownership structure, because I know you're family sure. held, but I'm sure there may be other people who have a stock or two.
Yeah, so we just, as I said, finished our fiscal year in October, about slightly over $50 million we did in revenue. And actually, contrary to everything I learned at business school, I pay no attention to the revenue line. I look only at gross profit. So all of our KPIs, and not even, I mean, operating profits certainly, but top line, all our targets are GP driven. That's what we track to. And we earn healthy profit as a C Corp. I was, until my father died a year ago, I was a minority shareholder, and now, you know, 4 months ago, I'm majority ownership. We just got certified as a woman-owned business. So that is, I've been trying to think how to look at that as an attribute of the business and compete perhaps differently. But yeah, so I'm clearly majority owner, got some siblings in the business, and then some minority shareholders. I was just typing up before I got on with you, Minter, a resolution to buy back some of the minority shares because of the, you know, the valuation we got from my father's estate. We've got the cash to do that. So what I learned in the success in the business going from generation to generation is that ownership was very concentrated. So easy, you know, 100 years ago, it just went to the son, the daughters got and then a bunch of men died in one generation. So at any rate, I think that was one of the keys to the success in transitioning the business. You didn't have 35 shareholders in generation five. We just were very, very narrowly held. So
yes, I wanted to look at that because success over time and flexibility within seems to be very much in relationship to the ownership structure and the governance put in place.
Yeah.
And I was wondering just if you wanted to comment that, to what extent, I mean, outside of your own talents and so on, obviously, but to see just how has that contributed? And then, you know, what do you have to say about going public? You know, if someone came here, here's a big pot of gold, go public, you know, what advice would you give to others who have that being proffered out?
Yeah, you know what? I can't imagine that. I can't imagine saying yes to that because I don't get up in the morning thinking about how I'm going to make more money. And I don't. And again, so I've reached a certain point in my career and I'm financially fine, right? But I never wake up thinking, hey, how much money can I make today? Can I sell the company? When I was in a CEO networking group, everybody would talk about, you know, the sheer goal was always to double the size of the business or some purely financial goal. And it just doesn't, not only does it not get me out of bed in the morning, it doesn't give me the incredible energy you need to like run a business. I think about building something that will, as I said, be around for the next generation should they want it. I think about building a company that makes the people who work for us better. We talk about our you know, why do we exist statement is to expand possibilities. And I feel that right here, right in the heart. So how do I expand possibilities for people who work for us and our communities? And I think it's really fun to then be working on a business that is building indefinitely, hopefully into the future, versus just getting to a number. And that was all that I did. So zero interest in going public. The governance issue, right? The best thing about being CEO is you can do whatever you want, right? I remember when I was transitioning from my cousin, I called him up and I asked him, you know, can I do this? He said, you can do anything you want. And there's an incredible responsibility that goes with that. But that's, I think, the fun part of the job and what makes it creative and rewarding.
Well, I love that. Why expanding possibilities? It's very expansive, imaginative, and encompassing, because you can really bring it down to an individual who's the janitor, really, even, you know, that they could expand their possibilities up to you, to the clients, to the way the chemicals are being used to change utilizations, and so that's the beauty, of course, of specialty chemicals, is that they do have that strong value add in the product.
Right. And so here's the other notion that I've been playing with, and I threw it out to my board and there was sort of dead silence when I said this, but I want to be the chemical company that sells you less chemicals every year, that helps you use, you know, sells you fewer chemicals, less chemistry. Yeah, because again, thinking about expanding possibilities, thinking about building a truly sustainable business, and the obligation I've got to the generations behind me, nobody wants to use our products. You know, you have to in some cases, but, you know, how do we help our customers use less? And that's, at the end of the day, fairly self-serving, because if they're more profitable, then they exist for a long time, they buy from us. So that's a pretty simple
virtuous
equation. Mm-hmm. But we're bringing out a product this year that is it's used in cleaning chemistry, which is one of our biggest product lines, and it reduces cleaner consumption by 35% to 60%, right? And I've got most of my sales team saying, I'm not going to sell this, like, forget about it, right? There goes my commission. But we've got customers who are spending hundreds and thousands of dollars on water that they're then pouring down the drain. So it's a recycling technology that will help them use less, spend less. So then I got to figure out how to get that revenue back. But I think that's what I really want to do with the business. Help people use less chemistry, the chemical.
That's fascinating. I mean, and things that I had to deal with myself would be aligning the incentives.
Right.
Because that may all be great in your mind. Your children may be happy, the grandchildren happier yet. But the salesperson say, well, you know, that's my volume. And so getting them on board, how much does the purpose have a purpose in that discussion? Can you go to the guy or the woman and say, listen, I know this is going to drop your commission by, but, you know, listen, we're here expanding possibilities. They're like, yeah, but not my pocketbook.
Yeah, exactly. Not their possibilities, right? So half my charges expand their possibilities. So I think, yeah, no one is going to be running behind you if you're saying, oh, by the way, you're going to earn less, right? So I'll be tilting at that windmill and my army will be back at the hotel. But what we've been in the process, even before the pandemic, but this notion of a sales transformation and changing how we engage with the customer, changing how we compensate the sales team, that notion of commission is perhaps old fashioned. There's a lot of thinking that says, doesn't matter, doesn't influence behavior. But there's a book called The Machine by Justin Roth, somebody, that really changed.
I'll find it for the show notes.
Yeah, no, it's really good. And we haven't gone to his extreme model, but taken a lot of what he advocates to heart. But you know what, for the longer term, if we don't do this, we don't help our customers, somebody else will. And then I think increasingly the people who do resonate with the why, so the generation that's coming up, they need a purpose, they need a why, they need something more than going out and selling another drum of caustic soda. So I think over time, people who come work at our company and stay at our company will be those who buy into that notion of expanding possibilities, selling less chemistry, developing products that maybe use less water, heat, or whatever it may be.
So going back to the governance question, Molly, you're a majority shareholder, owner, you're running, you know, chairman, CEO. How do you favor or allow for dissent? Molly, you're full of shit. That's the wrong thing. Get over it. Bad. Right. How does that happen? How do you allow for it? Do you allow for it? And just where do you want to go? Because otherwise it could sound like insubordination.
Right. No, I mean, try to encourage it. And that was when I took over as CEO, that was, you know, my first priority was culture and making sure that we had a culture of candor, right? So forget about everything that we were doing. We need to be able to talk directly to each other, disagree, have that conflict and move on. So I think at an executive team level, I've got plenty of naysayers. And then we do, you know, some of the things that one does anyway. You have a red team or you black hat something. But really, my board is best at asking me the really hard questions and pushing me if I haven't given them the right answer. So they're a board of directors, you know, largely advisory, I guess, in reality. But I've got on my board a guy named Bill Fidler, who was CEO of Brenntag North America, so world's largest chemical company. He ran North America, incredibly knowledgeable. And so, you know, he knows if what I'm saying makes sense or if it's sheer frontier gibberish, and will be very clear in telling me so. And I've got an extraordinary board, and they're the ones who push me and challenge me the most, I think.
So the beginning of the year, I interviewed somebody who's written a book about how to constitute a good board of governors. He was focused more on smaller companies because at this point, you know, if you're running a $50 billion company, it's another kind of situation. But what advice do you have? And you're looking in at your board where you might see gaps and improvements. How do you constitute a good board? I mean, you have this chap, Bill, who's very knowledgeable about the industry. You obviously have to have knowledge about the industry. Yeah. But how do you ensure the right type of overview? Because if everyone knows and comes from the same area, boom. Yeah.
No, I think that's a good question, Major. And I also see over time as the board gets comfortable with one another, perhaps that edge comes off, right, as it would with an executive team. So I'm in the process right now of thinking I've got two board seats coming available in the spring. So what skill sets do I need beyond that? What, looking really for more diversity on the board. We got plenty of women. I've got no person of color in my company that is, oh my goodness. I've got one white collar person. So I'm thinking about that. But, you know, I think take a board member who's got the right skill set. What you need, and it's probably the same with executive team. You need someone who's fearless. And there's a woman who works for us. She's our vice president of HR. And I think her superpower is really that fearlessness. She doesn't need to be working at this point. She loves what she does. She'll be the one who tells me I'm full of shit because she's got nothing to lose. And
that does help, right? When you don't have anything to lose and, you know, you fire me, that's your problem. It's on you.
Right. I'm going to tell you exactly what I think. And, you know, I'll get the calls after, you know, it's like, Molly, you know, that was a really bad idea. And so you need that same approach in the board. Challenge with the board over time is maybe they want to stay. I mean, do you lose that edge? And it's hard to gauge, but I think it's important to keep challenging, making sure you got the right board.
When you hire people at your company, Molly, I don't know to what extent you're specifically involved in each hire, of course, but you said at the very beginning, earlier you said that you're really involved in the culture of the company. Mm-hmm. Is there something that you've learned in the hiring process to ensure as best as possible you get the right fit? What is it that, is there a question? Is it a system? Is it just a feeling? What is it that you've learned at this point?
I've learned that I'm really bad at interviewing,
delegate.
Right, you know, talking to my controller earlier, we hired somebody after like three bad hires. We finally got the person we needed, who not only fit culture, but had this. We're all trying to find curiosity, right? So somebody who's got initiative and beyond every box you check, it's that. And I'm so bad at finding it because I don't know. I'm just a bad.
Well, you're honest. You're honest, which is such a refreshing quality for a CEO to admit things like that. And I have to say, I feel, please don't take it any other way than a compliment, that's a very feminine characteristic. Oh. It's that authentic sense of being able to say, I'm not good at that.
Yeah.
You know, the bravado that says, of course I'm good at that. Well, damn it, I have to hire. Right. I mean, I know, because I felt that personally.
Yeah.
In my experience.
Right. I think once you get to a point as a CEO where you're not, where you think you're good at everything, right? Boy, should, you know, danger, Will Robinson, should that robot be going off? And I had an interesting experience recently where, well, so I used to basically interview anybody, not the first round of interviews, but almost anyone who came to the company, I'd be involved, because it's not just hiring, it's an adoption for a company our size, right? 97 people. But I took a sabbatical in October, a month off, first time I've taken 4 weeks off since birth of my last child 16 years ago, and lots of reasons to do it. And we hired, I think, three people while I was gone. So the first time that was, I was not involved at all. The hires were fine, right? So it's a little bit of letting go. I don't think of myself as a micromanager at all, but boy, can I dive in when I'm not needed, and bottleneck things. So it was interesting to see how that process went without me being involved. It was a little bit faster. So far, you know, 2 months in, the hires look good. And then obviously the managers who are hiring felt completely, they own it. Like, they own this person they hired because I had nothing to do with it, which is good.
So have you decided to take a step back from further hirings, or are you going to, you know, what are you going to take from that thought?
The general principle is I don't need to be involved in things I don't need to be involved in, right? So that sounds really simple, but So I've got to do a better job, particularly as I'm trying to think about growing the business, thinking we're kind of entering acquisition mode. So there are going to be things that are going to take up my time. So I've got to stop doing things I don't need to be doing.
Right.
So I think that's sort of the key takeaway.
Cool. So I want to
we went through the same process on strategic planning, which I always really spent a lot of time doing in August, October. And I sent my leadership team off with five questions to answer and said, okay, you guys do it, right? Same idea that they, instead of it being my strategic plan, it's theirs, they own it. And, you know, I'd say it was about 70% successful. It came back with good stuff. You know, there's one rabbit hole that we're still trying to pull ourselves back out of, but a good process.
That's cool. Well, it's, you know, there's the idea of a 100% successful meeting is probably an illusion. Yeah. So the last sort of zone I want to talk about is my ballywick of branding, marketing, yeah, things yeah, like that. Yeah. And you're brazen on your website writing about how Hubbard Hall is unabashedly old school. I think that was lovely. We're going to talk about that in a moment, but let's talk first about Hubbard Hall. What is the importance of brand in your business, and how do you describe that?
The importance of, I think I say this succinctly, Minter. It's what I want people to think about when they think of Hubbard Hall. I want them to think that, you know, we're a trusted partner and that we've got expertise, so that our branding then around that tries to reinforce that. Because with our types of chemistry, people don't want to change it until they have to, right? So part of the branding challenge is, there's a couple different analogies, right? So you don't replace your windshield until it's cracked. And then you're like, oh my gosh, call 1-800-GIANT-GLASS because they've, you know, you've seen those ads endlessly. So the importance of branding is to create that awareness. And then the specific awareness for us, because again, we're dealing with hazardous chemicals, is these guys know what they're doing, high level of expertise, and we can trust them. The longevity of the business, I think, plays into that. A lot of marketing firms will tell you it doesn't matter how old you are, but I do think it's a quick signal that, yeah, these guys are stable. They'll be here through the next pandemic. But, you know, we've been spending a lot more in branding, and I hope my sales team never listens to this. The other thing I believe is that with proper branding and with proper marketing, I never need another salesperson. And I think that particularly as buying is changing, the rise of digital and that whole process, there's no, the notion of, you know, knocking on the door and saying, hey, would you like to buy my caustic soda is completely, it's ridiculous. And so what I want to do is, you know, for every dollar we're not spending in sales, that dollar is going to marketing. And we've taken the budget, I mean, it's almost doubled this year, I think, looking for outside resources, because we need to create that brand awareness. We need to have people find us. When they find us, we need to take them through that sort of
funnel.
The funnel and the lowering of the risk really, really quickly. And then hard to do, because with a brand, right, how do you talk to an engineer at Boeing in a way that is compelling and authentic, and the same way you need to speak to maybe a person who's running her own little plating shop up in New Hampshire. So it's a challenge. So I welcome your advice, Minter.
Well, you know, you mentioned on your site this notion of unabashedly old school, and we believe in shaking hands and old fashionedness. And I'm wondering to what extent then the pandemic has somehow shifted the gun to the other shoulder, or as we say in French, and understood that, well, actually the old fashioned meetings, conventions and conferences, which can't happen, we're actually doing fine without it.
Right.
And has that really shifted your perception? You know, and do you think that's something that's sustainable then in a world where we're allowed to go back on the airplane, Boeing included, right, to conferences and conventions?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly shifted. I think what helped us going into the pandemic, so, you know, for 6 months, you couldn't have a salesperson in a car and a customer, but there's a relationship and a trust we built up over many, many, many years, right, that helped us through and shorten the conversations. But I sort of liken it to a marriage, right? You can only have a marriage that goes on for so long remotely, and eventually you need to get together. I don't know.
Especially if you want kids.
Especially if you want kids, or, you know. So I guess there are other things that need to signify what it means to be old-fashioned. But again, I would go back to, as we communicate on Zoom, as we have digital meetings, what's unabashedly authentic or old-fashioned is having great customer service, a great customer experience. Now, we're going to deliver in a completely different way. We've launched chat this year. We've got our portal. We're launching e-commerce. But our goal is to be our customer's best supplier. That's top of our quality policy. So that's, if you call that authentic and old-fashioned, yeah, we'll stick with that, but just deliver it in a completely different way.
Social media has disrupted a lot, internet and so on, obviously all the different technologies out there. I worked in a space for 16 years, B to B to C.
Yeah.
You're in basically a B2B world.
Yeah.
And very industrial, hardcore. In your experience, Molly, from the things that you've studied, obviously you're more invested in Hubbard Hull, but how the word trust, do you think it is a bigger deal in your industry in a B2B environment than it actually plays in a B2C or a B2B2C kind of environment?
I mean, it's hard to compare the two, but I think it's foundational, if you will, because if we are selling somebody a chemical that's going onto a airplane part that's going up in the air, right, the risk aversion is so high, so they need to trust us. They need to trust when we give them advice that it's the correct advice. So, I don't know if it's more or less important in B2C, but in our world, I think it's where it starts and ends. And and then it goes back to the whole company, right? If they can't, people can't trust me. If people can't trust other people in the company, I don't know if it's a word that you throw around, but it's just who you are.
Yeah. Well, that's where the authenticity story comes in. And you kind of have to have a bad rating to help you understand, when I say it is good, it's good. When I tell you it's crap, I'm afraid it is.
Right.
And that ability to have that honesty about yourself, knowing that behind that, you're not going to get the order, which means you're not going to get the performance, which means, you know, I'm not going to get the commission.
Yeah.
And how do you accept for, I've got a wobble here, as opposed to, I'm always perfect?
Right. Well, I think that's maybe for us the upside of having a long-term view, right? We don't need to make the sale tomorrow or next year. We need to be making the sale 5 years from now. So hopefully that gives the sales team power in front of a customer to say, actually, no, we're not very good at this, or no, we can't help you right now, because you know, if we get it wrong, we know that that damage to our reputation and our perception of Hubbard Hall as a trustworthy company is gone. It's gone maybe in that company, that industry. So again, we can make decisions that and have interactions that may be suboptimal currently, but serve a longer term goal.
But that long-term goal, Molly, as I understand it, has to be supported by the governance and family ownership structure. Yes. Because other specialty chemical companies that are beholden to Wall Street don't quite have that same luxury.
No, that's true. So we can't be profitless. we need to take the monies that we earn and invest them back in the business. And so we are competing against fewer, I mean, in our realm, it's not so much the public companies, but the private equity companies. And we know when one is getting ready to be sold, because all of a sudden margins they go down the toilet and, you know, things go to hell. But we keep our head down and choose those more specialty areas. And then it's much harder to displace us. Not that it's impossible. And we'd be silly to think that we can't be replaced, but I have very little interest in selling truckloads of stuff and making pennies on the pound. If I can sell a drum of something that's specialty oriented, more fun, more interesting, longer term annuity. So
higher value. So going back to this notion of trust and the new world of digital, how do you see that playing out? When the old shake the hand, the I've known you for 20 years, I embraced you at your wedding, you know, let's say the old fashioned, old school type of thought, I played golf with you, I know that you always cheat when you're on the 16th hole. How do you play that out in a way that you sustain in a sustainable manner, trust? Because that's really the issue there. The sustainability of your business in the term that you were using relies on the sustainability of that trust.
Yeah. And I don't have a good answer for that. I can't think about, I'm trying to imagine a year from now what has replaced the golf game to be building those those communities and those relationships. I do think it can happen. Maybe it takes more time, and this doesn't quite answer your question, but I think we've all seen that the pandemic, all of a sudden people are much more accessible than they ever used to be. So my ability to have a conversation or a Zoom call with a CEO that I might only have seen on the golf course, and it took us forever to like figure out that meeting, now I can have it much sooner. So I don't think it answers your question about trust. It's a really good one.
It's a hard one. I mean, you know, like telling me how to be trustworthy, well, that's also pretty abstract as well. In looking at the, well, let's say the role of leadership with a family, seventh generation, hopefully coming along. I was wondering also if you could comment on your experience in hockey as it pertains to your leadership style and what you brought into that. And are there other sports that you would also think that would be useful for that? But specifically with your experience, Molly, as a woman, very competitive. I've seen it. I've experienced it. What has it brought to you in your leadership?
Well, firstly, it's only ice hockey that counts. So you can just take all the other sports off, forget about squash, forget about soccer. It's only hockey that matters.
Well, you know, I'm a reasonably large fan of an NHL team down the pike. My roommate at university was captain of the university hockey team. Two of his players played for the NHL. So I'm definitely invested in hockey. So I'm dying to hear what you have to say about some ice hockey.
Gosh, there's so much to say. I think the ethos of hockey is very interesting to me. And so, for example, if I go out and play pickup hockey now and play with, it's usually a bunch of men, right? Get my own locker room because I'm the only girl there. And people unspokenly play at the right level. So if I'm going up against an 18-year-old guy, he's not going to check me. Or try to humiliate me. So I think there's, and I've seen that in the hockey players I've met, pretty down to earth, straightforward, no bullshit. You know, you go out and get the job done, work as a team, because you can't get anything done on the ice by yourself. And that ethos is something I really admire, and I think translates into how you lead a business too, right? Just be who you are, get stuff done.
At the level of the person you're with.
Right.
Because deking out and making you look like an arsehole actually makes you look like an arsehole. I wanted to give you a little story that you make me remind me of, which is when I was running the division up in L'Oreal, Canada. So Canadians are reasonably good at hockey.
Right. Point taken.
And they yet invited out this numbskull to come out who I know how to skate backwards.
Right.
Not quite the way you're supposed to. Generally speaking, I'm stuffed in goal, but you're supposed to know how to skate when you're in goal. But anyway, they had me out, and I had this extraordinary, I'd played five times for L'Oreal's team. And I have this one recollection where we had some people who were ex sort of WHL, AHL kind of players. And so these guys, they really, and women, they knew what they were playing. Mm. And I mean, it was mostly guys, but I remember this one time they're in the corner. They're like three on the of our players the forwards were scrambling, and I was playing forward, but three of our players were in the corners fighting out with the defenseman, and there I was left alone, and I hadn't barely done anything. And anyway, they fussed and fought, and then one guy looks up and he saw me, scoops backhand and just feathers the pass right in my way for me to do the slap shot.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is it. This is my, you know, Gretzky moment. And I just wind up and I do this wonderful, if I were doing ballet, it would have been a pirouette. And the puck just continued on its merry way past me. Yeah, and I ended up on my ass. And so, of course, there's one side of me thinking, well, I'm the boss, so that's why they're going to be nice to me. But not at all. They got me up, you know, hey, Minter, you can do it again. And a little bit later in the match, I got another chance, and they still passed it to me. Yeah. And it turns out I scored. But the point was that they were at my level, and they encouraged me at my level, not because I was the boss, because they certainly didn't give me any quarter in other times. Right. You know, when I'm fussing and fighting, I'm in the corner, they're pushing me like you do.
Right.
And anyway, I think that's a great credit to the ice hockey culture and the Canadians in particular, because all they wanted me to do was to love hockey.
Right, right. And on the ice, who doesn't love the game? And it's fun when you are in an environment where everybody just wants to be there, is making it happen and loves it. And so again, how do you take that into the back into the business? And I played in college, played as an adult, and then I started coaching my girls, my twins. So I started a girls program, and it was an interesting parallel for me. I mean, I was still skating, but to come off the ice and become a coach, it sort of paralleled my journey as CEO. Like, you can't be on the ice anymore, right? You've got to be thinking about a plan. You got to be coming up with a strategy, and then trusting your team to execute, right? You can tell them everything, but I never believe in, as a coach, yelling from the bench, because they're not going to hear it. They either know, you know, they're either well-trained and know what they're supposed to do, or they don't. And I remember, like, it was U-12 girls hockey. We were going to the finals, right? So this was my high point, probably as a person, right up there. You know, I had coached these girls who couldn't even skate, and we're going to the finals. And one of my two daughters in the back said, you know, Mom, it must be really hard to be a coach because you have no impact on the game. I said, what do you mean? I got you here. But it was, she's right, right? I mean, at that point, once we get there, and so great point in leadership, right? And then the other thing I love about hockey even now is, so that was a humbling moment, and for me now the humility is, I had one of those fanning on the puck moments, and I'm not particularly a good hockey player. My intentions really are much better than my execution. And so I can go from 5 days in the office where everybody tells me how smart I am and how funny I am, and they laugh at my jokes, and then, man, am I embarrassed when I get on the ice and fan on a puck or fall down. And so it's a great, great counterbalance for me right now.
Yeah, in my new book, I have this thing called the Czech framework, and for leaders, and the H in the Czech stands for humility. And it's remarkable how that doesn't happen. And it's kind of programmed not to happen as the boss. You're always, everyone's laughing at your jokes. Everyone thinks you're smart. And it's just sort of the natural way we have programmed society. So you have to be ultra careful to bring it back in.
Yeah, and I've learned that in a family business, right? So I've done everything here. I'm looking at my warehouse. I can drive the forklift. I'll shovel the walk if, you know, people aren't here. And then yesterday in our corporate headquarters, I was sitting in my office looking out, and there's this like stack of toilet paper that's been there for 3 days. I'm like, why won't somebody take care of it? And then I realized, well, you know, I guess I'll just go take care of it, and could have called somebody to do it, but I don't know. It just made me think about all the little things that go into making the business work, and every job has meaning and purpose. And so, yeah, I restacked the toilet paper and used my lean principles. So I got some business stuff in there, but
That's smart. So Molly, just finish a book, a mentor, someone you've inspires you, how anyone you would like to share with us or give some kudos to before we sign off with your own credentials.
Yeah, I'll give you two. One was a woman, she's on our board now. My father made her my mentor early on, and she was the person always in my corner saying, you can do it. And you can, whatever vision you have for the company, you can do it, you can do it, you can do it. So that relentless cheerleader who pushed me at times, you know, when I didn't see it. And the other one is my father. So as I said, he died almost exactly a year ago. And I would not, if you'd asked me a year ago, was he a mentor? No, because I was pushing against much of his beliefs and his tenets, and I'm trying to remake the company. And now I think, wow, you know, God damn it, he was right, you know? And so it's good to have a lot of cash. When in the pandemic, I wasn't worried about not being able to make payroll. This notion of sometimes making a decision, like disagreed with him when he told me, like, you gotta make a decision quickly, right? That's my approach. Said it's okay to take a night to think about this big decision. He said some of my biggest regrets have been saying yes when I should have thought about it more quickly. And then the way he led, he didn't say anything, but he led with humility. He led with kindness, and his word was gold. And so this notion of trust, right? And just someone just told me this yesterday, Minter, that when he was coming to the U.S. 20 years ago from a British company called Canning, they said, well, if you want to do business on a handshake with anyone in the United States, call Chuck Kellogg. So that is my dad, right? So that's was a very powerful lesson to me that I didn't know I was getting at the time from him. This is, you know, be who you are. And I think he also inspired for me this notion of what our duty is to the people who work for us. And I remember going through the parking lot 10 years ago, and he said, oh, Dave bought a new car. I'm like, yeah, well, so Dave bought a new car. And it made him really happy to see that Dave bought a new car because he had a good living and could take that risk. Didn't understand it at the time, but now I feel that's my job is to make sure that Dave can buy a new car next year.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
So I know that you guys like staying old fashioned, but how would you, if someone is listening to this and wanted to get in touch or find out more about Hubbard Hall, what probably digital way would you recommend for people?
Well, Hubbard Hall, so clearly our website, hubbardhall.com, and then LinkedIn is how I'm making most of my newer connections, although not all of them, but those are the best two ways. And then there's the old-fashioned way. I occasionally get a phone call and I'll pick it up. It's another lesson I learned from my father. He answered his phone, gave anybody 30 seconds, and if they didn't convince him, the phone went down. And otherwise, the conversation went on.
Beautiful. Molly, you are a wonderful inspiration. It's great to have your trueness come through. And lovely, some wonderful words and good wisdom. So thanks for coming on, Molly. Talk to you soon. Can't wait to hug you in real life again.
I know, Minter. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having listened to this recording of the Minter Dialogue Show. You'll find the show notes and other blog posts on MinterDial.com. If you enjoyed the show, please head over to iTunes to give a rating and review. And to finish, here's a song I wrote with Stephanie Singer, A Convinced Man. I won't tell the lie.
tell myself there's no use in me lying. I'm a convinced man building an earth. I'm a convinced man to live and die sober. A convinced man in the arms of a woman. I'm a convinced man, challenge my fate. Challenge, so life's not incomplete. What's wrong with challenge? I know soon we all die. I like the feel of a stranger tucked around me, precipitating the danger to feel free. Trust in my reason and let me show you why.
The Jim Stroud Podcast explores the discoveries and trends forming the future of our lives. Brain-to-brain communication, robot bosses, microchip implants for workers, and artificial intelligence replacing human workers are all happening now. If you want to know what's happening next, subscribe now to the Jim Stroud Podcast.